Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're going to be looking today at rail and World War II. We probably won't finish it, and I don't want to rush things, because actually it's important. All too often, when people discuss the history of rail, or indeed of many other things, they're talking about what essentially is the peacetime history. This, of course, is not terribly helpful, because A, war was an important period in aggregate terms in the first half of the 20th century, but also because the impact of war in matters such as infrastructure, rolling stock, labour relations, government regulation, financial profitability was all quite continued, quite considerable. So let's start off. Let's start off with the Philadelphia Inquirer, which you can look up online, the image, in its issue of the 13th of February 1942, presented one of an America fully committed to war production. And a train plays a prominent role in that, and rightly so. Trains served America and other combatants in moving troops and equipment, and also in facilitating unprecedented rates of industrial production. Moreover, in the case of America, devastating German submarine attacks on American coastal shipping in early 42 further encouraged a reliance on rail, as indeed they'd already done in Britain. I think it's fair to say that World War II was much more important than World War I in the suppressing coastal shipping and therefore enforcing, for example, in the United States, and therefore enforcing a greater reliance on rail. Rail dominated the land choice of transport, although pipelines, river and canal barges and road transport still all played a significant role. And of course, the Big Inch, the oil pipeline from Texas to the oil refineries of New Jersey, essentially was the substitute for coastal shipping of oil, rather than actually switching most of it to railways. The development of air power, which was much greater in its capability and usage in World War II than it had been in World War I, posed a major threat to rail services during the war. There was a massive focus on air attacks on railways, bridges, stations, and rolling stock, with vast destruction. Rail facilities, after all, were very difficult to disguise and protect, and they were present in all pre-war maps, and they showed up very easily in aerial reconnaissance. And we have the aerial reconnaissance pictures, photographs that the Germans produced for the Luftwaffe of British cities, and they very much have marked in the big rail stations. German air attacks, indeed, on the British rail system were particularly acute in the winter of 1940 to 41, with major damage specifically to the many stations in London and Liverpool. German aerial reconnaissance and other systems of target allocation made much of identifying rail facilities for bombing. As a result, repair work, often by night, was crucial to the continual running of services. Much of this work conducted while in danger of renewed attack. And that's a reminder that there was considerable heroism, as well as the fortitude of a strong sense of duty during World War II. And much of that was shown by civilians as well as by those in military service. In turn, the Anglo-American combined bomber offensive on Germany included an Allied attempt to destroy German rail infrastructure, and with it the articulation of the German economy, as the integration of manufacturing on many sites was required, for example, to build tanks. With limited oil supplies and the resulting reliance on coal, as well as having fewer trucks than Britain and America, the German war economy concentrated on train links, as did that of German-allied and German-occupied Europe. Despite the limited precision of bombing by high-flying aircraft dropping what we would now call dumb bombs, just think of them as free-fall bombs as opposed to guided munitions, Allied strategic bombing was crucial to the disruption of German communications and logistics, largely because it was eventually done on such a massive scale and because the targets could not be attacked by any other means. Indeed, there is an enormous amount of naivety talked in criticism of the Anglo-American combined air offensive. I mean, it's a great tragedy, the casualties. I mean, the casualties among the Allied air crew. But the damage to the German economy was crucial, and there was no other way of hitting at it. Damage also included, for example, 45% of the French rail network that was under German control in 1940 to 44. And that damage was extensive enough to preclude, on the whole, though not always, effective repairs, which indicated the potential for increasing returns to scale in the air offensive. In other words, you increase the scale, which very much happened in the last 6 months of the combined Allied air offensive on Germany. You increase the scale, and then you do proportionately far more damage because it's difficult to repair it. So to give you an idea, the deadly Anglo-American air attacks on Dresden in 1945 were principally launched because it was a rail hub behind Germany's Eastern Front. This was not intended simply as a terror attack. The British Joint Intelligence Committee had established that stopping German troop movements to the Silesian Front was a high priority. The Soviet Union had also sought this assistance. The night before the attacks, Colonel Harold Cook, who was an American prisoner held in the Friedrichstadt marshalling yard in Dresden, described, quote, miles of freight cars loaded with supplies, supported and transporting German logistics towards the east. And those were effectively targeted in the bombing offensive on the city. Rail systems have far less flexibility than road. Switching routes is much harder. They're also harder to repair than roads. The raw materials are less readily available and costlier to supply, the iron in particular. And crucial points proved particular targets for attack. This was true of bridges, for example, over the Seine in 1944, all below Paris. All of those bridges were destroyed as part of the Allied attempt to limit German reinforcements coming to the Normandy area. Now, that only succeeded in part, but one has to ask, as so often when one's considering effectiveness, what would have happened if they hadn't damaged or destroyed what they did do? It was also true of marshalling yards. For example, the German one at Hamm near the Ruhr industrial belt in 1943. And indeed, British broadcasts, the BBC News, during the war often included, you know, bombers hit Hamm this evening. There was also considerable strafing of individual trains, which were larger and more vulnerable targets than individual lorries, because obviously they moved in a predictable fashion. A lorry can swerve, a train is, as it were, trapped by the railway on which it is. An aircraft carrying cannon proved particularly effective. For example, on the 8th of August 1945, between the two atomic bomb attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, American fighters machine-gunned railway stations and trains in Kyushu. The reason they were attacking Kyushu, the largest of the home islands, was because that was the destination zone for the American landings planned for later in 45, landings that would have been extraordinarily costly in both American lives and in Japanese lives had the Nagasaki, the second atom bomb, not persuaded the Japanese that this was it, that it was time to surrender. One of the trains approaching Kikuchi Station had, quote, bodies piled on top of bodies in the carriages that were awash in blood. There was no real air defences in Japan by the summer of 1945. There were Japanese aircraft put up, and they did shoot down some Allied bombers. But the air attack was pretty both systematic and successful at that point on southern Japan, which was well within air reach of the major American air bases established in the Western Pacific, not the case with, say, Hokkaido, northernmost island. And what that meant was that they were starting the process of softening up for the invasion. There were, as in World War One and the interwar period, armoured trains, as well as trains mounting powerful guns, some of which indeed were adapted to provide anti-aircraft fire. But they, you know, there was only so much they could do because they were moving in a predictable axis. But it's interesting to see the use of these armoured trains. Canada, Italy, Japan, Germany, and in particular the Soviet Union all had armoured trains. The Slovak national uprising against the Germans in 1944 made use of rapidly adapted trains. The Soviets deployed trains mounting powerful guns at Sevastopol, keeping them protected in tunnels from which they moved forward in 1942 to fire at the besieging Germans. And the British themselves deployed 12 armoured trains in 1940 when fearful of invasion, and the last one was only withdrawn from service in November 1944. Its vulnerabilities ensured that the rail system was also prone to partisan attack in occupied areas, as in Denmark and France. In many cases, resistance activity proved more effective than bombing, not least because the attackers could call on assistance from rail workers, as in France, as depicted in the film The Train, 1964, which was very loosely based on successful attempts to stop the movement of seized art from Paris in August 44. The Polish resistance claimed to have damaged 6,930 locomotives and 19,058 wagons, to have blown up 38 railway bridges, and to have delayed repairs to 803 locomotives. These vulnerabilities forced a heavy burden of defence on the Germans and their allies. It included adding troops and firepower to trains, the latter making them armed rather than armoured trains. And the protection of the train system was difficult. Moreover, particularly when needing to check for explosives, this protection greatly slowed up the speed of rail movements and therefore the efficiency of their usage. However, the movement, despite this damage, some movements of supplies by rail were continued. For example, the Germans were able to continue to get oil from Ploiesti in Romania, the leading producer of oil west of the Soviet Union. And this was maintained despite air and resistance attacks. In invading the Soviet Union in 1941, confronting its vast space compared to the more limited extent of earlier campaign theatres, the Germans found that the railway system in Poland and the Western Soviet Union collapsed the first winter of the war with the Soviet Union, with serious consequences for their forces on the Eastern Front. An unusually cold winter ensured that the poorly winterized German locomotives were hard hit, notably with their piping. Their lack of heated repair sheds added to the difficulties. And in consequence, serviceability rates were only about 20 to 40% for several weeks, which was an enormous strain for German logistics in the winter, in the face of the Soviet counteroffensive, which had begun in December 41. In contrast, the Soviets were more experienced in the use of their railways. These were significant for the rapid, epic, and highly successful move of factories eastwards in late 41, away from the range of German land and air attack. So the Soviets moved, for example, their tank factories enormous distances and switched them back to full production very rapidly. Then rail provided the means to bring forward supplies and material once manufactured. So also with foreign supplies. The limitations of the supply route across Iran ensured the need to rely on Western supplies landed at Archangel and further west Murmansk, from which rail links took supplies to near the front. And indeed, the Germans and their Finnish ally failed to cut the vulnerable rail link from Murmansk, and as a result of which the supplies moved in the Arctic convoys could be transported south. Without the railway, this wouldn't have been possible. American supplies, in turn, were moved forward in along the Trans-Siberian Railway, having been transported across the near the North Pacific. Now, on the American side, the key movement was not by rail, it was by road, the Alaska Highway, built in 42. And indeed also by sea, moving supplies up to Russia that way. But anyway, the rail would not have been possible to have built as effective a system as quickly as the Alaska Highway. And road restoration was also more successful in Alaska in dealing with permafrost thawing than would have been possible for rail. The Soviets also addressed the need for new rail links. For example, the Germans had planned a road bridge across the Kerch Strait east of Crimea to serve German strategic interests in the Caucasus. Of course, Vladimir Putin eventually had one of those. It was never completed because the Red Army advanced back into Ukraine in 44. Instead, the bridge section stockpiled at Kerch enabled the Soviets to complete it as a railway bridge, which reflected their particular logistical needs and capabilities. From October 44 to February 45, the bridge supported the Soviet advance by providing a transport route into Crimea until it broke up under the pressure of ice. More generally, railways were required to carry larger, heavier, and different loads than in campaigns a half century earlier. For example, large numbers of tanks. Despite being under air attack, the Germans continued to be able to do so, as in late 44, when tanks were moved from the eastern to the western front in preparation for launching the offensive that was to be known as the Battle of the Bulge. As in the previous war, existing passenger rolling stock moved large numbers of troops. The process of mobilization and deployment at the beginning of the war was followed by the use of trains in successive campaigns to move troops towards the fronts. They also played a part in withdrawals. Outside Europe, rail also played an important military role. For example, the Italian war with Britain in Africa in 1940 to 43, Italy's Eritrean line was necessary in a colony almost without oil in order to supply the front line. Without oil, it was very difficult to do much by way of road transport. In Somalia, the Juba Front was supplied again for the Italians until February 41 by rail, as no other means were sufficient. Also in Libya, the small network between Tripoli and Tobruk was used to move forward supplies. It wasn't a complete network, but it provided a partial network. This use of rail saved oil and so reduced pressure on vehicles, which was an important plus for the Germans and the Italians. For all the powers, the demands of war, both military and economic, were formidable, and requests for locomotives and rolling stocks were frequently not met. For example, between May 42 and September 43, the government of India ordered 1,375 locomotives, but by the end of 1943 had received only 105, and it proved necessary to turn more to coastal transport. Now, as we know with the Bengal famine, some Indian commentators, not all, I'm glad to say, can prove paranoid in the extreme about the very unfortunate Bengal famine, alleging all sorts of things about the British. It's worth bearing in mind that India was not alone in having inadequate stock of rail for its locomotives. Rail logistics posed major requirements, which were met by the combined use of peacetime skills and wartime capability. For example, in doubling track, improving handling facilities, and providing relevant supplies. Thus, the Americans were able to deliver the locomotives and wagons necessary to increase dramatically the capacity of the rail system in Algeria, which they invaded in 1942. This increase was essential to support their very large force as it moved east to attack the Germans and the Italians in Tunisia. And the United States Military Railway Service, that was its title, ran operating and shop battalions, taking responsibility for the maintenance of rolling stock near the front line. At the same time, ironically, the enormous damage done by Allied air assault caused major problems for the Allies as they advanced. So also did German destruction as their forces retreated. Partly as a consequence, but largely due to the necessary speed and scale and to the dispersed distribution pattern that was caused by the multiple axes on which the Allies were advancing, Allied logistics in the advance across northern France depended very heavily on trucks. Now, I think it's well to say that the necessary adaptability was not always demonstrated. So, for example, the Burmese railway proved resistant in 1941 to 1942 to making the changes necessary to deal with the crisis of Japanese attack. Changes advocated by Colonel Francis Biddulph, the director of military transportation, who had run military railways during the First World War on the Western Front and in Italy. But once the Japanese had conquered Burma in 42, the British proved adept at militarizing the transport system in northeast India, an area which had not hitherto had to make such preparations. In part, this was a matter of the interplay of imperial military traditions and the difficulties introducing what was seen in pre-war Britain as best practice. Biddulph had been chief instructor at Longmoor in Britain, where running military railways was taught. His superior there, Lionel Manton, became India's first director of transportation. In contrast, Japan failed to make comparable improvements to the system they had taken over. Now, the interactions of diplomacy and blockade were significant to the movement of resources and for neutrals as well as combatants. For example, the German-Soviet Pact of 1939, somehow Mr. President Putin doesn't seem to refer to that when he makes his stereotypical attacks on Germany in World War II. The German-Soviet Pact of 1939 undermined the British plan to use blockade to weaken Germany. Instead, there was a great expansion of German-Soviet rail traffic, although that had been limited by poor rail links and trains still had to stop to change gauges at the old border between Poland and the Soviet Union, a border that was now within the Soviet Union after its conquest of eastern Poland in September 1939. Avoiding Allied naval power prompted the Axis states to advance plans for new rail routes. These were also designed to lead to the articulation of new imperial spheres by replacing pre-existing territorial and the associated gaps in rail provision. Thus, the German plans for Eastern Europe and the conquered parts of the Soviet Union included rail and road services. In turn, the Japanese building of links between Thailand and Burma, the 258-mile Burma Railway built in 1942 to 43, was an instance of this process, a fatal one for many of those used as forced labour, including British prisoners of war. More numerous than those were the Asian civilians who died in this construction. The railway was designed to supply the Japanese forces in Burma and thus prepare for the invasion of northeast India, launched without success in 1944, stopped at Impala and Coima. This route avoided the lengthy maritime route around Malaya, which would have absorbed considerable shipping resources and exposed them to Allied attack, against which it would have been necessary to deploy warships and aircraft. The Japanese reliance on unskilled forced labor was an aspect of the primitive nature of the execution, as was the need to use tracks and sleepers from dismantled railways in Malaya and the Dutch East Indies. The Japanese also planned, or at least considered, an improvement in their rail system to link Japan proper, Korea, Manchuria, and the conquered regions in northern China. To do that, they improved the rail system in Korea and Manchuria, and planned a tunnel link between Kyushu and Korea, and planned a new rail route between Tokyo and Osaka, some of the railways being dug. And indeed, the plan was revived for the later bullet train line, finished in 1964. A revival of past schemes was also seen with the Vichy interest in a Trans-Saharan rail link, which was proposed as a way to retain control of French West Africa in the face of British and Free French maritime pressure. In the event, only a small portion was built, and the implausible project was made redundant in November 1942 when Anglo-American forces conquered Algeria and Morocco. Rail was also fundamental to the operation of the German concentration camp system, and indeed the problems affecting German trains in Eastern Europe in the winter of 41 to 42 led to delay in the development and operation of the envisaged rate of mass slaughter. Jews had been first deported by rail from Germany in late 38 when those of Polish descent were expelled. Subsequently, the situation became far more deadly. Jews were moved long distances to slaughter, notably from Western Europe, and also from local ghettos to extermination camps, with the transport ministry playing an important organizational role. About 2.5 million Jews were taken to death camps in 42 to 43 alone. I mean, obviously many more followed later, and in conditions of cruelly imposed squalor. A comparison with the luxury of the private trains enjoyed by the Nazi leaders is beyond irony. There has, of course, been debate as to whether the Allies should have bombed the railways taking Jews to the camps and as to how effective that might have been. The great range of such operations and the consequences for aircraft vulnerability and bomb loads that range brought, the number of other targets, in other words, in accountancy terms, the opportunity costs, and the speed with which the Germans could repair the lines were all germane factors. Ultimately, the only way to end the Holocaust was to overthrow the Nazi regime, which helped to explain the salience of targeting the war economy. In other words, every manufacturing city producing tanks and submarines that was flattened was helping to end the Holocaust. Opened in October 42, Auschwitz III, which was not an extermination camp, it was a deadly concentration camp, was at first to supply forced labor for nearby industrial facilities run by the company IG Farben. Unlike the other extermination camps, indeed, Auschwitz was located in a key economic region, coal-rich Upper Silesia, and in an area where there was a large concentration of industrial production and trains. Trains were also used for deportation within the Soviet Union, as with Chechens or Crimean Tatars, with those deported moved to gulags or labor camps, especially in Siberia. And the extent to which the Second World War remains politically resonant is shown by the political memorialization of such movements. So, for example, the end of Soviet rule was followed by the display of wagons used for such deportations, as in the Latvian Museum of the Occupation, which is actually a rather good museum. In terms of the number of services, civilian rail was generally cut, and the organizational burden of running rail rose greatly, even without the disruptions and risks of enemy attack. This risk was much enhanced, as we've mentioned, due to the increasing range of aircraft and indeed the greater bomb load they could carry, and the recognition that railways should be targets with no differentiation for civilian use. Wartime increased freight load and therefore locomotive power. Scheduling was complicated by drivers operating in blackout, which increased the need for familiarization with particular routes. And timetables were put under stress, and without any real regularity in job in demand. There's a lot of rush jobs in wartime military logistics. The special and specific nature of military requirements, as in the preparations in Britain for the invasion of Normandy in 44, created even greater problems and pressure. Capacities, individual and collective, human and machine, were all put under stress. Trains were also used for the evacuation of civilians threatened by bombing, the evacuation of children and others from British cities at the start of the war. Saw about 1.3 million people moved by train in a fortnight, an unprecedented movement and a sign of the sophistication, organisational power and multiple provision of the British rail system. And this was achieved by special trains. There was no comparable movement in 39 of evacuees by road or sea. Now, road transport itself was hit hard with the higher prices for fuel and with limited availability. As a result, passenger usage of rail could rise as it did in Britain. In part, this also reflected the extent to which wartime disruption to family life and not only service leave encouraged people to travel to see relations and others. With many trains taken up with wartime tasks, other services were fewer, more crowded, and often subject to cancellation. Trains were slower and usually dark so as to prevent spotting by hostile aircraft. In fact, often the only thing you could really see was the tip of people's cigarettes lit. Accidents increased, including falling off dark platforms. A lack of maintenance led to slower running of trains over more uneven track, and this resulted in more delays. And novels of wartime rail travel, such as those of Edmund Crispin, were of dismal journeys, as in his novel The Moving Toy Shop, 1946, in which his protagonist goes to Oxford. Quote, "I had a pretty bloody journey from London, very slow train, stopped at every telegraph pole like a dog." A more romantic context was provided by the British film Brief Encounter of 1945, which was shot at Carnforth Railway Station, based on a 1936 play. In it, the character Laura Jessen goes on a weekly train journey to a town for shopping and an afternoon film and emotional entanglement. The war saw government control of railways, as in the intercompany freight rolling stock control introduced in Britain. This control prepared the way for post-war nationalisation, notably in Britain, not least by reducing the financial strength of the companies. In that respect, wartime was a continuation of the Depression. In Britain, companies were only allowed to retain a portion of their profits, which was useful while sources of income, such as first-class travel in 1941, restaurant cars in 1944, were abolished in order to increase capacity. Furthermore, routine maintenance decreased greatly, and there was no routine replacement of locomotives. Pre-war plans for improvement were abandoned, as was the practice of remaining fit for purpose. This had consequences in terms not only of wartime accidents, but also a higher rate of accidents after the war than before it. The rail system in 45 to 47 was in a mess in Britain. So also with wartime breakdowns in locomotives. Obsolescence characterized rail systems as a whole because there was inadequate, as it were, work on for other than stopgap purposes. And this was going, and they were going to find the return of peacetime welcome, but difficult. Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. A huge range of issues to discuss, but perhaps I might just start by asking, did the German military, did they have their own division of train drivers and so on, or as they pushed into occupied territory, whether westwards in France or eastwards into the Soviet Union, did they just forcefully engage civilian French or Soviet train drivers as and when they were occupied to do the driving and the all the different aspects of keeping the railway lines going? What was there a military division running these things, or was it entirely co-opted?
Well, it was largely co-opted. I mean, the there was only so much of an ability of the Germans to run logistics. I mean, essentially, they needed to be proactive in areas that were under military administration, which was obviously the Soviet Union, a vast area. But in France and in the Netherlands, they were able to a considerable extent, use the existing organizational structures. And that, of course, helps to explain the post-war litigation about, which has led to the payment of damages and apologies in the case of France, the French railways and the Dutch railways for the movement of Jews. I mean, it tends to be, you've got to bear in mind that the German Empire in Europe is multifaceted. In some areas, it is an alliance system, let's say Bulgaria. In other, which doesn't preclude the Germans having a role, but it's an alliance system. In some areas, the Allies are pretty awkward, Finland, for example. In some areas, there is the establishment of a Quisling regime, but sometimes it's more or less dependent upon German assistance. Some areas are under direct military administration, but a military administration that, as it were, is operating as a pseudo-government, which I think you could say is the case in, say, Belgium. And in some areas, it's downright, military rule and often very immediate effect in a very inchoate, disorganized and violent practice. And I would say the classic instance of that is the Soviet Union.
The efforts to neuter the use of railway lines during the war, I mean, I'm keen to just explore a little bit more as to how that developed. In an age of the kind of the heavy bombers, I assume the targets are the railway stations and the termini primarily. And is it the case that until D-Day and thereafter, I mean, it wasn't really possible to get the smaller bombers like fighter bombers like the Typhoon to bomb more limited targets, be it kind of bridges with railways crossing and so on? You see, they really all the focus had to be on the large stations. Or how did the attack evolve in terms of picking off different railway lines and different strategic points with more detail?
Well, a lot of it's to do with range. And obviously, the larger the bomber, the more fuel it can carry, the greater its range. So you can do tip and run raids with a relatively light fighter bomber across the channel because the range isn't too great. And then you can use those. As you'll appreciate, you're not going to be using those to bomb a railway line near Stuttgart, say, unless you're thinking of by the time you've got drop tanks, drop fuel tanks, which give the fighters greater range. I think it's more the question that you should understand that the Allies have an enormous pressure, and a lot has been written about this, the Allies have an enormous pressure of competing requirements and suggestions for the use of air power. So to just go, without in any way being exhaustive, there's strong pressure to use your long-range planes to suppress submarines moving on the surface, particularly in the Bay of Biscay, because once they go below the surface, they are slower and therefore they have a lower cruising distance. And as you may know, there's big rows between the Bomber Harris, who wants to focus on his bombing of Germany, and as it were, any other diversion. Other diversions include area diversions. I mean, how many aircraft are the Americans going to base, for example, in the big air bases constructed near Bari and in Apulia, from which to fly up and bomb Munich and targets in the Balkans? So there is, I think it's fair to say that the problem is that railways can be identified as a strategic target, but as a strategic target, they vie with other strategic targets. Closer to the front line, they're appropriate targets for tactical air power, and tactical air power is important, but tactical air power is often diverted or focused on what is immediately to the front of you in terms of enemy combat units. So you pretty well need to determine that you are going to have a major effort against railways. Now, from the German perspective in the Blitz, their railways represent, as they do for the Allies, railway marshalling yards and railway stations are more accessible targets because they are larger than rail lines. And what that does is encourage the use of aircraft of whatever range, and the German planes being thrown at Britain in 1940-41 are not long-range planes, they're medium bombers. They encourage the use of aircraft against those targets. Once you move, now the German bombing, and there's quite a lot of controversy as to what the Luftwaffe was trying to do in 40-41. There is the argument it was trying to break civilian will. There is the argument that the prime economic target was the docks and they were trying to starve Britain. So the railways were important, but the Germans wanted a short war. They had a short war air strategy. The Allies, in contrast, in the combined bomber offensive, have a long war strategy, I would argue. And that means that you want to degrade their industrial production capability with specific reference to particular industrial targets. So, you know, famously in places like Schweinfurt, for example, the ball bearings factories. But the key element there of attacking rail links is that everybody understands that railways provide the articulation in an industrial economy in which, for anything that's complex, a jet aircraft, a submarine, a tank, you are compiling it from a multitude of parts which are provided by a series of factories in different areas. Now, the Germans do, and I mentioned Silesia, you know, out the Auschwitz area, they do actually put in sometimes new economic plants and, as it were, an economic zone there. But on the whole, they're having to operate with their existing industrial system, which is designed to be articulated through trains.
And just to circle back on one of the great controversies you were talking about, and that is the argument as to whether the Allies should have focused more on bombing the railway lines approaching in and out of Auschwitz. I mean, I understood you to argue that really the best strategy was the defeat of Germany, and anything that was focused on that was ultimately to the benefit of ending the Holocaust. But had there been a strategy to attack the railway lines, from roughly when onwards would they have been within range of the right sort of planes to bomb? And is it, just to be very clear, is it your sense that would probably not have lasted for very long, which is to say repairs could have been made quite rapidly?
Well, it's usually argued, and with reason, that the principal mass slaughter that would have been effective, or could have been effected, or in some people's eyes should have been thus effected, is that of the Hungarian Jews in 1944, which is the last major episode of the Holocaust. And well, that's one has to be careful there. There are obviously lots of killings subsequently, but over 430,000 people were killed, mostly in Auschwitz too. It's a terrible episode, as indeed is the whole sorry tale. I think as far as bombing is concerned, and of course, by the summer of 44, the Allies have good air bases in southern Italy from which they could fly north, and they're also got sophisticated fighters using drop tanks to give them the long range to escort heavy bombers and confront German aerial interceptors over Germany and further east. And of course, they'd, in so-called Big Week, they'd achieved a degree of aerial superiority over the Luftwaffe. So I don't think there's much doubt that they could have bombed those targets. I doubt very much that they could have had a systematic campaign. And if you're thinking of the specific slaughter, mass slaughter of Jews, unfortunately, the Germans and their allies had shown themselves well capable of slaughtering tens of thousands of people in the field. And indeed, if you go to Budapest, you will know that along on the side of the Danube, there's a very piquant memory, memorial, I should say, of shoes concreted in, which is because a large number of Jews were taken to the side of the Danube. They had to take their shoes off because these were regarded as of some value, and then they were shot and pushed into the river. So let's be under no illusions here. The Germans would have killed, I mean, you know, it wasn't just Hitler, it wasn't just Himmler. There was a widely diffused anti-Semitic blood frenzy among Germans and their allies in this period, and they would have killed the Jews wherever they could have done, and indeed they did.
Well, a fascinating episode. I'm afraid, Professor Black, we must leave it there. But for discussing the use of railways in the Second World War, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.